This podcast is brought to you by Proact Safety, the global leader in safety culture excellence. Find them online at proactsafety.com.
Thanks for tuning in to this EHS Today podcast. I'm Associate Editor Laura Walter. Today, we're discussing safety culture, why it's important, and how it can be created, defined, measured, and maintained. Here to offer his expertise on this issue is the founder and CEO of Proact Safety, Terry Mathis. Prior to founding Proact, Terry was a director of training for Coca-Cola, where he developed several new and innovative approaches to safety. He is a nationally recognized expert in the application of behavior-based safety strategies and is a veteran of over 900 safety improvement projects in 29 countries. Terry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Laura. It's an honor to be here.
First, tell us a bit about Proact Safety. How did it get started, and who are the major players?
Well, in 1993, I left another major consulting company and started Proact Safety in conjunction with a very brilliant man named Dean Spitzer. Dean is currently the head of internal consulting for IBM, worked with me for about a year and a half to get the company started before taking that position. A little bit later, Sean Galloway, who's now the president of Proact Safety, came on board, as did Ben Akery, who's our senior consultant. We have the opportunity to work with clients who are really world-class safety performers around the world who are looking for the next step change, and where they can go from here. I guess I rather naively thought that some of the people who were bad at safety would be our first clients, and it just hasn't been the case. It seems like everyone who wants our services are basically people who are already excellent, looking for the way to be even better.
In your experience working with different types of clients around the globe, what is a major focus right now for organizations that already have world-class safety programs?
Well, the real buzzword out there that I'm hearing is culture. A lot of organizations have been doing the basics for many years. They started with management. They started with compliance issues. They worked up through the behavioral issues and a number of the other popular ways to approach safety over the years. Most of them are very mature in their processes right now, and they look around and say, okay, if we're not at zero already, what's the last piece? What's the other thing that we could do to get to that level of excellence we're looking for? And the word that's coming back to me more often than anything is culture.
Why do these organizations think culture is an important part of their safety efforts?
Well, I hear two different sets of reasons coming back. One is they've looked around and said, basically, we've addressed everything else. This must be the last piece. But a lot of this is being fed by some of the studies and some of the things that have happened out there in the world over the last few years. One of the ones I hear quoted very often is the story of the British Petroleum Texas City disaster. When the Baker Report made their final report on what happened out there, the word culture appeared many, many times in that. They talked about the cultural issues that created the focus or lack of focus on certain areas that made this disaster a possibility. And I think it got the attention of a lot of these really good safety performers for several reasons. One is that they realized that BP was one of them. This was one of the companies that had low incident rates, that had on the surface all the programs and things in place that should have prevented a disaster like this. So I think part of this was the, well, if it happened to them, it could happen to us mentality. And then the other, I think, is also they realized that if a large organization like that had a blind spot, maybe they have one also. And that if the blind spot for that one was culture, maybe that's the one that they should be looking at.
If an organization is interested in redefining its safety culture, what are some of the first steps it should take?
Well, first steps are an interesting prospect to me. I'm probably as guilty as a number of other consultants of having in the past, and I'm talking about many years ago, of course, now, jumping into projects and trying to figure out how to make a difference. Having become old and a little bit better doctor in my old age, I firmly believe that you shouldn't prescribe before you diagnose. And I really believe that the first step for trying to make any kind of a safety culture improvement is truly understanding what your starting point is. So what we're talking about is assessing the starting point in your safety culture. Where are you right now? What are the issues that are impacting you? And as we've looked at this for several of the large organizations, especially the Fortune 50 and Fortune 100 companies that we've dealt with, there have been some real surprises to them and to us about what some of the issues are out there that are actually impacting their culture. So assess your culture, find out what your starting point is, and then customize a plan to make it better.
How can company leaders or management help define the safety culture?
Well, interestingly, some of them think they don't when in fact they actually do. Leadership and management, to whatever extent it happens in safety, is a major impact on the safety culture. As a matter of fact, many of the experts out there in safety culture right now say that safety begins at the top, that safety begins with leadership, begins with management style. Some people go so far as to say that that's the major defining factor in it. Whichever position you take out there in the scale of how impactful it is, you have to realize it's an impact. The leaders set the tone for the organization, and especially what they said, whether they realize it or not, is the priority of safety in the organization. You know, is the safety culture one of the major elements in the company, or is it a secondary thing behind production, behind quality, behind other priorities? Most workers in most organizations listen very carefully, even between the lines, to what their managers and leaders are thinking and saying, and trying to read into it where their safety efforts ought to be focused and what level of priority they have in the organization. So one of the things that leaders can do is simply communicate. When we poll workers and we say, what is the level of priority of safety in your organization? Almost all of them give us an answer. And when we probe even further and say, how did you determine that? The most common thing we hear back is that I determined that this is the level of priority of safety in our organization because this is the level at which my boss communicates safety to me in relation to other priorities.
Well, you mentioned communication, and maybe you could elaborate on that a bit. How does communication impact safety culture, and what can organizations do to ensure their communication methods are effective?
Excellent question. One of the things that comes to mind in almost anything that you ask, how do you make sure this is working? A lot of organizations have no way to tell if their safety communication is working. And what I'm talking about is they don't measure it. They don't measure the volume of it. They don't measure the effectiveness of it. And one of the ways to measure the effectiveness of safety communication is simply to see if the message has been received. One of the great experts in communication said that communication is what the receiver does, not what the sender does of the message. And however you look at communication, you have to realize it's a two-part process. Somebody sends a message, somebody else receives the message. And if you don't get everything from the sender to the receiver, then somewhere in between, there was something that's compromising the quality of your communication. We go into organizations very often and we ask the safety professional, how do you communicate details of an accident back to the workforce? And they tell us. But then we go out to the workforce and say, when an accident happens around here, how do you hear the details? And very often what we hear isn't what the safety professional prescribed. Very often there's an official channel of communication, but it depends on a number of people and sometimes even a chain of command. And so we find out that out there in the organization, there are people who actually block the flow of communication from one level to another. In fact, in the Baker Report, this was one of the things that they pointed out, was that in the safety communication, they said they had two kinds of sensors. What they really wanted were sensors spelled with an S, S-E-N-S-O-R-S, people who picked up information and forwarded it so that action could be taken to improve safety. But what they had in many instances were sensors with a C, C-E-N-S-O-R-S, people who actually blocked and filtered the information, tried to keep the bad news from going to the boss or from getting to a level in the organization organization where it wouldn't be appreciated and might not positively impact their rating in the organization, but certainly where action could potentially be taken on it and disasters like Texas City could be averted. Basically, the answer to your question is you need to measure communication. You need to measure the amount of it, you need to measure the effectiveness of it, and you probably need to measure the perceptions of the people who are receiving it to see what was happening. We read an article just recently in the Harvard Business Journal, and we started doing some studies based on it. One of the questions that was asked by a communications expert at HBJ was, how often do you communicate? And this person asked the people that he was questioning to keep a log for 90 days and to see how many communication opportunities they had and how many they actually took advantage of. So based on this kind of thinking, we went into several organizations and asked the same question, specifically directed to safety communication. We said, how often do you talk to anybody out there in your organization, and how often in those communications do you make safety part of the communication that you're giving? Most of the managers and supervisors that we polled rated themselves very high just asking the question. They say, well, I think I talk about it quite often. We asked them to keep this log for 90 days, and at the end of 90 days, we met with them again, asked them to take out their logs and said, how did you do? And there were a lot of looks, that, as you can imagine, around the room of people wincing a little bit and saying, oh, you know, we don't do as well as we thought we did. This is a highlight of just simply the importance of measuring. It's almost impossible to improve anything that you're not measuring. If you don't have any way to measure it, how do you know if it's improving or not? And we find that most organizations don't have a formal plan or a formal measurement for the effectiveness and the amount of safety communication going out to their workplace.
How do you measure safety culture?
Well, it's a complex thing to measure, and I'm afraid that there are a lot of folks out there taking a very simplistic approach to measuring it right now. When you look online or you look out there at the safety shows and events, and you look for instruments that people are trying to sell as a safety culture measurement tool, what I see most often are simply perception surveys. There's nothing wrong with measuring perceptions, but to conclude that a simple measure of perceptions is truly a measure of culture is a very, very oversimplification. Culture certainly impacts perceptions. Perceptions impact culture. But to think that a simple measurement of perceptions is a really accurate reflection of everything that's in the culture has several limitations. First of all, perceptions are very, very volatile. Perception is a very difficult thing to measure and to measure accurately. And by volatile, what I mean is that perceptions very often can be changed by significant events almost overnight. I guess a good example this year, we're getting into a presidential debate. I've been listening now for 6 months to who would win the election if it were held today. Well, your perception of who would be the best or the least bad, however you look at that, next president of the United States is being impacted on a daily basis by news stories, by things that are being put out by the press, by things like the conferences that are being held. In a likewise manner, if you're going to measure safety perceptions, what happens if you have a major accident and then you measure the perceptions immediately after? Are they going to be drastically different than if you had measured them right before? What if you have an event that doesn't impact safety but impacts morale at the site, such as a layoff, a reorganization? All of these things can impact the perceptions. And knowing how these influences are out there in your workplace and where they fell in relation to your measuring of perceptions is critical. But in addition to the volatility of measuring perceptions, there's another real problem that I see in measuring perceptions in general, and that is that there are two kinds of perceptions. There are accurate perceptions and there are inaccurate perceptions. And when you simply ask people, what do you think about this, you don't know if what they think is accurate or if what they think is inaccurate. And that's why I think if you're really going to measure a safety culture, that in addition to measuring perceptions, you've got to anchor those perceptual information to real information, such as data analysis of the accident, near-miss data at the site. I very often ask people when assessing a safety culture, what do you think your greatest risk is? And then I go look at their accident data and I find out what their greatest risk is, actually. In some instances, workers know what's happening to their fellow workers more often than anything else, and in many instances, they don't. And in many instances, what they think is their greatest risk is truly not their greatest risk. And something that they think is not a particular risk is truly their greatest one. So it's not just enough to measure what people think about it. You've got to find out how accurate that is. One of the things, if you're going to take a perception survey and you're going to work on what you perceive to be your deficits, working on an incorrect perception is a totally different thing than working on a correct perception. What if, for instance, your workers say, "I don't think my supervisor gives safety a very high priority"? Well, if that's an inaccurate perception, you may only need to give the workers more information about precisely what their supervisor does and how often they do it, and the perception may be corrected and you're off and running. If, on the other hand, the perception is that the supervisors don't give enough priority to safety, and the reality is that the supervisors don't give enough priority to safety, you have a much bigger job to fix this than merely correcting a misperception. You're going to have to define programs, possibly do training, and then once you've taken the steps to get your supervisors more actively involved in safety, you're going to have to communicate and publicize that to make sure that not only is it the new reality, but that it corrects the old perception of the old reality. So I think safety culture is probably the measurement of it is a much more complex issue than a lot of people would like to give it credit for right now.
What are the critical areas of safety culture that should be measured?
Well, we have a list that we kind of go by, and we have literally hundreds of issues that we look for, but they all fall into 8 categories. This is kind of the methodology that we use for most of the cultures. Number one, we look for the status of safety at the site. How mature is the safety effort right now? How good are the meetings? How good is the training? How do people view the safety professionals and the safety staff at the site? We look at the whole status of where they are. We also look at that in terms of results. Has the site been able to successfully decrease their accident rates, their severity rates over the past few years? Or are they actually going the wrong direction or just in a state of stasis out there? Where are they in that? We also look at support for safety, and this is where your earlier questions come in. How does management, how does leadership impact the safety culture? Well, they support it or they don't support it. And this support or lack of support is a very critical area in developing a successful safety culture. One that's not supported struggles to get what it needs to truly be successful in safety. One that is supported has an easier time, but sometimes even the support can step across the line, and where it's not supporting and empowering, but rather dabbling and interfering with what's happening in the safety culture. So you have to look at those levels. We also look at staffing. In today's lean, downsized world, very often safety is very adversely impacted by a shortage of staff. You don't have enough people to do the job. You don't have enough people to do the job safely. You don't have enough people to run the plant and hold a safety meeting at the same time. There's an amazing amount of safety being done on overtime. We look at skill levels also. How much training do the people have? Do they really know how to do their jobs safely? How do they transfer skills? What's the onboarding process for a new employee coming into the organization? Is he brought up to speed through formal classroom training or on-the-job training, mentoring? How does this happen? We look at strategies also. Does the site have a strategy for building a successful safety culture, and how well are they executing it? We also look at their schedule. What people are on at what time? You know, how long are the shifts? What's the rotation? It's amazing how the hours you work impacts your ability to be safe on the job. And our 8th, this is what we call snipers. Who are the people who are taking pot shots at safety? Who are the people who can derail safety efforts and make them not go where you want them to go? Those are the major areas we look for, and we measure them not only through perceptions, but through interviews, through assessing accident data at the site, and a number of other methods to put this all together and try to find out the reality of what's really happening in the safety culture.
Once you have made a safety culture assessment, how do you act on it?
Well, never in a prescribed, formulated way. Every safety culture is unique, and once you've identified the deficit, you have to start taking action to supplement implement the deficits in the safety culture, and a very important part of that is measuring what you're doing to make sure that whatever action you're taking is really working and really making a difference.
How can you measure the safety culture improvements that have been made?
Well, that's an interesting one, too. You know, obviously you can impact perceptions, but you can also impact realities. And if you have performance metrics, leading as well as lagging, you can see how these things are impacting those and ultimately how all of these are impacting the downstream or lagging results. For instance, if your culture is not well trained and you implement a safety training feature, you can measure that safety training feature to see if it's really happening. Then you can measure to see if it's changing perceptions and skills. Then you can measure to see if it's actually changing safety results in the form of accident data over a period of time.
How long do improvements in safety culture last?
Well, that's an interesting thing. If you truly do change the culture, culture is actually a sustainability tool, as is habit. Anything that becomes automatic, anything that becomes ingrained, has the potential to last long term. So once you actually have this established as a part of the safety culture, the main control is to control the things that influence safety culture. The culture itself has a tremendous amount of stasis and stability and will maintain its practices long term as long as there's not something else pushing on it to try to make it change. So once we have the culture, and I'm talking about the work culture, which some people call the subculture in the organization, below the management level, once you have that in a really good state of stasis, the main thing to control is the management and supervisory influence to maintain it long term. And if you do that, safety cultures can last indefinitely. I went to a site many years ago that I always remember. This site had not had a recordable accident in 45 years, and I hadn't worked with the site, hadn't been one of my clients. I drove out to the site just to see what they did, and before I could step out of the company vehicle, someone met me to make sure that I had all my safety equipment that I had signed in at the gate, and that I knew what the safety issues were, and that the escort who was with me was certified to be an escort for someone there at the site. It was no mystery to see why this site had had such excellence over that many years, because their culture just reinforced it on a daily basis.
What do organizations need to do on an ongoing basis to keep their safety culture on track?
Well, obviously they need to measure it periodically. And most organizations that we talk to have gotten in the habit of measuring their safety culture every 2 to 5 years. I don't think that's nearly often enough. So that means you need to develop probably a lower cost way to measure your culture and to administer this on a regular basis to see, for instance, if the things that you're doing to keep your safety culture on track are truly keeping your safety culture on track. If you have an organized plan and you have a way to measure your progress toward that plan, that's where we find the organizations finding the true excellence that they're looking for in forming and maintaining their safety cultures.
Terry, thank you for speaking to us about safety culture today.
My pleasure.
Since 1993, thousands of people across the globe have trusted PROACT Safety to help them customize an approach to achieve and sustain safety culture excellence. To learn more about organizational and culture safety assessments, lean behavior-based safety, leadership safety coaching, balanced scorecards for safety, or for free downloadable audio advice, visit us online at www.proactsafety.com. PROACT Safety, the global leader in safety culture excellence.
We'd like to thank Terry Mathis for joining us in this discussion and PROACT Safety for sponsoring this EHS Today podcast. And for our listeners, thanks for tuning in. We wish all of you a safe and productive day.